See so many of you here. For those of you that don't know me, if you're new here, if you're not used to Metro, my name's Philip. Really good to see you. And you will have picked up that this evening we're doing a whole exploration of what's the point. I don't know how you found the video with Matt going out onto the streets with his tight costume, accosting people, causing nuisance and concern, but asking that question, what's the point of life? And I wonder if you had been questioned on that video, what you would have said. What is the point? For me, it was striking how many people said, I don't know. Or they look for things like friends or fun, all these superficial, shallow things, which are not bad in themselves. But are they really the point? Do they really give us meaning? Do they really supply us with the kind of hope that we're looking for? Now, if you're new to church, then you may think that Christians are all about coming up with trite answers. You may have thought that the Bible is full of fairy tales and children's stories and belief in stuff that we really know is not true at all, and we've grown beyond that. We don't need that Harry Potter stuff. You may feel like that. Maybe you've come because you were curious. Maybe you've come because a friend brought you. Maybe you were bribed. Some of you, maybe, I don't know, you were dragged here. And you find yourself here. What I want to do over these next few moments is I want to go through a book in the Bible. Because sometimes people think that the Bible is full of easy answers. It's full of just little greeting card statements. But what we're going to do, and this is a bit of a tough job that I've set myself, so I'm going to do my best. But we're going to look at one of the ancient documents from the Near East, 3,000 years old. And it's a book called Ecclesiastes. And it's an incredible book. It's 12 chapters. There's a lot to it. And I'd like to just look at it and give you a little bit of an overview of this book. But before I do, just to get you into the mindset, I want to ask you a riddle. Now, it's an easy riddle, so if you know it, don't shout out. But here's the riddle. If you know this, great. If you don't, see if you can figure it out. Like I said, it's really easy. It's straightforward. It's not complicated at all. But it's this. She's my mother, but it was impossible for her to carry me. She's my wife, but it was impossible for her to marry me. Simple riddle. She's my mother, but it was impossible for her to carry me. She's my wife, but it was impossible for her to marry me. So this is a question, and we'll look a little bit at the riddle. If you haven't figured it out, it's super, super easy. But actually, if you don't know the answer, then it's kind of a little bit like the questions that we have in life. To one person, easy. To another person, really, really complex and hard to figure out. Now, this book, Ecclesiastes, like I said, it's 3,000 years old. It's an ancient manuscript. It's part of the Jewish scriptures, part of our Old Testament. And it's written by a guy who calls himself, well, in Hebrew, it's Kohelet. Everyone say Kohelet. Very good. You know Hebrew. Now, Kohelet, it's a word that's translated, different translations call it the preacher or the critic, the questioner, the questioner, the quester. But the translation that I think best sums it up is the teacher. And the teacher is someone who has reached the end of his life. He's someone that's looking back with the perspective of time. And he's asking the question, what's the point? What's life all about? Why are we here? Why do we have this few years on this planet, in this plane of existence? And rather from the Bible just shying away from the difficult questions, it's Christianity and it's the Bible that pushes us towards the difficult questions. Christianity, if you do it right, it's not a crutch for weak people to escape from the harsh reality. It's something to make you look at the harsh realities of life, to look with open eyes. And he starts his book off, and it's kind of a little bit stark. He says this, "Meaningless, meaningless," says the teacher. "Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless." So it's not the most encouraging start to a book. But this word meaningless, it means vapor, it's smoke. It's like it's hard to grasp a hold of. It's hard to get a handle of. It's hard to find what the meaning is in life. He says everything is meaningless. He takes this perspective. He says, look, if you think about the world, if you think about where we find ourselves, even for an ancient mind, they knew that the vastness of time makes our human lifespan almost irrelevant. He says this, what has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. It's a famous phrase, this is where it comes from. He says, no one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. The idea is this, that 13.8 billion years ago, a singularity explodes into unimaginable power. The Big Bang, the universe, time, space launched into existence. 4.5 billion years ago, give or take, our galaxy comes into being. Our Earth spins on its axis. And then through the course of millennia, the development of life and the development of humanity and creatures and biology as we know it. And now within humanity, within the thousands of years that we've existed as human beings, our lifespan is nothing. It's a blink. And the universe will march on without any concern for you, without any worry or knowledge of your pitiful existence. And billions of years will carry on until the universe finds itself in a kind of heat death, collapsing in on itself once more, and all existence is snuffed out. So it's meaningless. What's the point? Or if I put it another way, let me ask you a question. Do you know the name of your mother? Put your hand up if you love your mother. Okay, very good. Someone didn't put their hand up. I'm like, sort it out. Some of you are brand new students, and your mother is at home. You've come to Bristol. She's at home. She's crying. You should love your mother. You should at least know her name. On the count of three, I want you to shout out the name of your mother. One, two, three. Uh-huh. Nice. You know the name of your mother. That's not a big surprise. Do you know the name of your mother's mother? Your grandmother on your mother's side. Count three. One, two, three. Shout out. Very good. Good. Okay, do you know the name of your mother's mother, your grandmother's mother, okay? First name, shout out her name, one, two, three. Not bad. Put your hand up if you didn't know the name of your mother's mother. Okay, roughly half of you. I'll try one last one. Your mother's mother's mother. Shout out her name. Wow, we've got some archaeologists here. And the rest of you are going like, I just made something up. The fact of the matter is that for most of us living our lives, going about our daily existence, within three or four generations, even your family, even those that you have brought into this world, they won't know you. They won't remember you. It's meaningless. And the teacher, he looks hard and he looks long at the world and human existence and the march of time. He says, against that backdrop, it's all meaningless, meaningless, meaningless. But like we said in the video, humans are meaning-making machines. It's not enough for us to live without meaning or purpose. We want to find meaning, and we will desperately search for meaning, and we will ascribe meaning to things in order to get some kind of reason, purpose for living, some kind of fulfillment. And so what he does is he does what we all do. He tries to look at life and say, well, can I find meaning in this area? Can I find meaning in that area? And it's an amazing book. You need to go away and read it. Read your Bible, kids. It's incredible stuff. I'm just going to summarize very briefly five of the things that he looks at to find meaning in life. And the first thing that he looks for, he says, he looks at wisdom. Now, again, if you're here, you're brand new as a student, then you've come here to get understanding because you think that learning is going to make your life better. It's going to increase the quality of life, or it's going to make sense of life. The more we know, the more we understand about the world. He says this, I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. That phrase, under the heavens, is important. We'll come back to that. But he basically says, I set out to explore. Now, as far as we know, the author of Ecclesiastes is probably King Solomon, an ancient historical figure, but he had a reputation of being the wisest man in the world, the wisest man in the ancient world. He established a number of wisdom schools. He kicked off a whole kind of practice of Near Eastern wisdom. And he was renowned for writing, for scholarship, for parables, for proverbs. And he set his mind to wisdom. And sometimes we think, if I can find out enough about the world, I can make sense of it. If I get stuff in my brain, life will be better. Now, I remember coming to Bristol. I came here as a student back in the 18th century. And I did an engineering degree. I remember my first day of lectures in the Queen's building. If you're an engineer, shout out, huh. Wow, what an apathetic bunch of desperate people. But I was enthusiastic, not like you guys. I was totally up for it. Sorry for being rude. But there I was in the Queen's building in the lecture theatre, applied mechanics, Professor Jack Bones. He gets up, he does an introductory lecture. Like I said, it was the 18th century. We had blackboards in those days before you had technology and the internet. Blackboard with a chalk that you wrote on it, it would leave a little kind of dust residue that you could see, and you'd write notes in paper. So he's writing all these things and he's giving this lecture. He fills up the blackboard and then he does this thing that we have never seen anybody do before. He takes the blackboard rubber. He takes the blackboard rubber in one hand and instead of just moving it across the board to rub off what he's written, he takes the other hand and in sympathy moves the two together like this. Does the board. And we're like, what is this guy? He turns around and he says, students, I can tell by your astonished looks. You probably haven't seen anyone rub the board like this before. We said, no, we haven't. Your teachers at school never rubbed the board like this before. No, they didn't. He said, let me tell you why. When you were at school with your sad, undeveloped minds, without very great education, just at a very elementary level. Your school teacher didn't have the kind of learning and understanding that I have to know, and this is applied mechanics, my friends, that when you do this with one hand, you place on your body an out-of-balance moment. In other words, it's a force that is out of kilter with the rest of your body. It's asymmetrical upon you. And what happens is that when you do this, your bottom wiggles. He demonstrated his bottom wiggled. We applauded. He said, when you were at school, your teacher, they've probably wiggled their bottoms all the time. He said, yeah, come to think of it, yes. He says, but when I move the other hand in sympathy, no bottom wiggle. We all rose to our feet. We applauded. This is amazing. I thought, this is it. I am in university. I'm learning, book learning. I have got stuff that will equip me for life, enable me to get above just the common folk with their lack of understanding about how the world really works. I want to put this into practice. I went home. I was doing some notes. I used pencil, and I deliberately made a mistake. I got my rubber out. One hand, the rubber. The other hand moving in sympathy. Piece of paper went flying away. But the principle was established. That evening, I went to bed, I brushed my teeth, would shake people by the hand. Hello, I'm Philip. And I thought, this is just the tip of the iceberg. I've already learned something day one. And we laugh, but it's very easy to feel that if you have enough understanding, if you have enough knowledge, if you look at things deeply enough, somehow you'll find meaning, somehow you'll find life in it. My experience of university was that, sure, we learned stuff, and sure, it was good, and it was great, and it was helpful, and I enjoyed it. But it did not make any of us more happy, did not make any of us more fulfilled. I still had to sit and talk with my friends after the suicide attempt. I still had to talk people out of just the mires of sadness and heartbreak. Because when we learn stuff, it can make our lives easier. It can make our lives, I guess, in some ways, we have a better understanding of the world that we're in. But the fundamentals of life, meaning, well, you can't figure that out with a slide rule. You can't work that out with a computer program. And the teacher, he says this, I applied myself to understanding of wisdom, but I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. You're probably aware we have the kind of the new atheist movement that's arisen over the last 10, 20 years. Brilliant minds, brilliant writers, people like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, with all this knowledge, with all this wisdom. These guys, let me tell you, they know a lot of stuff, but they're not great fun to be with at parties. Because when you find out, the Bible says, the teacher says, the more you know, the more grief you get. There's like a burden of knowledge, working out and understanding that the world is not the fairy tale simple thing that you were led to believe that it was as a kid. If you watch and listen and read the new atheists, they will tell you, they'll go so far as to say this, you cannot be happy because you cannot have any meaning because there is no you. You is an illusion. It's the illusion of self. You don't exist. You're just a bag of chemical reactions. You're just a coming together of genes and chemistry that has no intrinsic meaning. And if you follow those things to its conclusion, you realize that it's impossible for us to find any kind of meaning because of all the things stacked against us. And you can be brilliant, and I'm not saying don't study, I'm not saying be ignorant, but it doesn't bring meaning. It just brings more questions. It makes us see that the world is a confusing place where the simple truths that we placed our faith in before don't hold up. Wisdom doesn't lead to meaning. So he says, let me try something else. He says, I'll try wine. Now, wine, pleasures. And I've just got to say up front, the five things, they all begin with W. It's a little bit cute, but it's just a way that we remember. Wisdom and wine. He said this, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Everyone say, with pleasure. To find out what is good. I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. My mind still guiding me with wisdom. In other words, you know, I'm like a clever guy, but I'm having a bit of a laugh. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. And so he's saying this, okay, if you grow wise and if you get lots of wisdom, understanding, and that doesn't find fulfillment, meaning, or happiness, then just go for it. Have pleasure. Enjoy yourself. Do what feels good. You might as well suck the marrow out of life. And so I'm into wine, I'm into pleasure, I'm into good things, I'm into just having a laugh, I'm into all these kinds of things, and I'm indulging my appetite. But you know, the thing about appetites is that it doesn't ever satisfy you. He then goes on to say this, he says, everyone's toil is for their mouth, yet their appetite is never satisfied. Why? Because that's the nature of appetite. Appetites are never fully or finally satisfied. And so you work so that you can get money to go out on the weekend and have fun, or you work so that you can eat and live well and have good food and good wine and good drink and good company. You work so that you can have the nice things and do fun stuff. You've got this appetite and you feed the appetite, but it's never satisfied. Better what the eye sees than the roving of the appetite. This too is meaningless. It's a chasing after the wind. And again, that word wind or meaningless, vapor, vanity, it just means, it's like, you know, when you were a kid and they had that thing where they were blowing bubbles on the lawn in the summer and you'd see the bubbles and they're bright and they're shiny and you'd go giggling and jogging after the bubble and then you'd grab a hold of the bubble, it's gone. The moment you try to grab a hold of it, it's gone. Because appetites don't lead
to fulfillment. Appetites just lead to more appetite. You can fulfill it one moment, and then the next moment, you're still missing. You're still hungry again. It's like that nursery rhyme, that thing that we used to do at play school when it says the farmer's in his den. Do you remember that one? Who knows the farmer's in his den? E-I-A-D-O, the farm. So the farmer, he wants a wife. He's got appetites. You know, he's a red-blooded male. He wants a wife. So the farmer's in his den. The farmer wants, he's got that appetite. Is that appetite going to fulfill? The farmer wants a wife. He gets a wife. But then the wife wants a child. The wife wants a child. And the thing doesn't stop. It carries on. And then the child wants a nurse. The child wants a nurse. E-I-A-D-O. And then the nurse wants a dog. And before you know it, we're all petting the dog, thinking, how did I get here? I don't even like dogs. Our appetites, they're never satisfied. You're always looking for the next thing, the next score, the next high, the next experience, the next event, the next meal, the next evening, the next holiday. And if you do this long enough, like the teacher, you find out it doesn't make any sense. Ultimately, it can't give you meaning. It distracts you for a little while. So wisdom, wine, the next one is work. He says, okay, maybe. You can't think yourself out of this because certain things are unknowable. We live in a random universe which is completely oblivious to our tiny, insignificant lives. And pleasures and wine and appetite always, always leads to more, never fully and finally satisfied. Maybe I can do something of significance. And this is what a lot of us get into. You know, we put our effort and our energy into work, into a career. He says this, I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. So he's working hard. And again, it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. But you find out that actually what you work towards, it doesn't satisfy. It doesn't last. And when you've been around the block a few times, like the teacher has, you look back and you just think, well, what was all that for? And some of you, you're going to spend the next 40 years working at a job, a number of jobs, and you're going to look back and think, well, what was that? What had that got to do with the price of fish on a Tuesday? What was it all for? What was the meaning? Because it hasn't actually impacted things in the way that I thought it would impact things, and it hasn't changed me. I remember when I was a kid and I was starting to work hard. You start to work hard at school, right? I would work hard, but sometimes you lack motivation. Sometimes you just don't want to do it. Sometimes you just can't be bothered with the homework. And so I'd be there with the kitchen table, with my books and stuff, and I'd just start to slack off. And my mum would come in and she'd say, Philip, you need to work hard. But why? Why do I need to work hard? You need to work hard so that you can get great results. Why do I need to work hard and get great results? You need great results so that you can go to an amazing university. Why do I need to go to an amazing university? So that you can get a brilliant job. Why? Why do I need to get a brilliant job? So that you can get lots of money. Why do I need lots of money? So that you can get a great big car and a great big television and a great big house, great big wife, great big kids. But why? Doesn't lead to anything. And Solomon, he says this, what do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labor under the sun? All their days, their work is grief and pain. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless. We live in a world where we were supposed to have all these labor-saving devices, robots, computers, make our lives better. We work harder than ever before. We work longer hours, particularly in the UK. We work longer hours on average than almost any other nation in the developed world. And what is it for? And what does it produce? And what does it make? And are we just producing tat or stuff which is good in the moment, but ultimately is not enough to live for? We can do great things. We can make a big impact, but ultimately, in the grand sweep of time, it's meaningless. It doesn't leave anything. And if you think hard about this stuff, it is actually quite depressing. And so the teacher goes on and he says, well, what about wealth? You know, I get lots of money together. He says this, I bought male and female servants and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. Historians will tell you that Solomon was probably the wealthiest man who had ever lived up to that point in history. In fact, you could argue that there has never been, relatively speaking, a wealthier man in all of human history. He had fabulous, incredible wealth. Wealth that you cannot imagine. And yet he goes through this. He says, you know what? It doesn't mean anything. You think it's going to mean something. You think it's going to help. You think it's going to change things. It doesn't change things because you're still you. And money, you find out, is a pretty poor kind of substitute for meaning, purpose, and fulfillment. He says there's four things. First of all, he says this. Whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. It's just meaningless. So, the American billionaire, John D. Rockefeller, the richest man in the world, the oil tycoon, he was once asked by a journalist, how much money is enough? Because you keep getting more and more and more and more. How much money is enough? John D. Rockefeller said, just a little bit more. Because you're never satisfied. You always want more. We already live in the prosperous, wealthy West, and yet we still want more. Not content with the fact that we have way more wealth and riches than 95% of the world's population. You know, they suffer. Billions of people on the planet today get by on less than a dollar a day. But we're okay. And we live in this kind of paradise, if we're honest. Even those of us that are not particularly well off, we have this paradise where we have all these wonderful resources at our disposal. We have wealth that others could only dream about. We have Costa coffee. We have smashed avocado on sourdough. We have all these things. Sure, it's kind of built on modern slavery and all these kind of oppression and injustices and unfair trade practices. But hey, we got IKEA, so it's all good. And yet, we want more. We're never satisfied. He says, number two, as goods increase, so do those who consume them. In other words, the more money you have, the more people come to take it from you. You know, when you have stuff, people just find their way to take money from you. He says, number three, the sleep of a laborer is sweet, whether they eat little or much. But as for the rich, their abundance permits them no sleep. In other words, when you have money, it makes you worry. When you have money, it makes you worry. When you have money, it makes you worry. The more money, the more worry. Because you worry that you're going to lose it. You're worried that you're not going to be in the manner that you were accustomed to. And then finally this, he says, I've seen a grievous evil under the sun. Wealth hoarded to the harm of its owners. In other words, there's a corrosiveness about money and wealth. It can eat into your soul. It can take away your humanity. It can make you greedy. There's a curious paradox that the more money that people have, the less generous that they are with it, proportionally. Because the more you have, the more you hoard, the more you hoard, the more it turns you into its possession. It harms you. And so finally, he says this. Women. That's the final W. Women. Now he's a guy. If you're a woman, then you just substitute men or relationships or sex. He says this, and it's kind of misogynistic, but he says this. I acquired a harem as well. Well, good for you. The delights of a man's heart. Okay, we get it. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. Too much information. I refused my heart no pleasure. All right, no need to brag. But this is a guy, and again, according to history, he had 700 wives, which are kind of political alliances. And then he had 300 concubines, which is basically 24/7 sex partners. So he had it coming out of his ears. And yet he says, still this. After a while, it doesn't satisfy. And you think, oh, yeah, but what about a good relationship with one partner for life? But then you think about it, and you think, marriage? What, 4 out of 10 marriages, they end in divorce. And that's marriage. You know, if you live together, you're 5 times more likely to break up. Cohabitation is so much less secure than marriage. But marriage in itself, how many of you, you've seen it in your home, you've seen it in your family, you've seen that heartache and that brokenness that comes when love goes wrong. Or suppose it goes really wonderfully right. You don't know what's going to happen. They may get sick. They may die. You don't know. They may change. You don't know what's going to happen. And this is when Solomon, the teacher, he brings it in. And this is the final bit where he really just summarizes the whole thing that makes life difficult. He says this, the race is not to the swift or the battle to the strong. In other words, it's random. You do your best, doesn't guarantee anything. You can be the best, doesn't mean that you're going to succeed. Nor does food come to the wise or wealth to the brilliant or favor to the learned. So what is it about? He says this, time and chance happen to them all. Moreover, no one knows when their hour will come. The march of time, the randomness of life, and the fact that you don't know when you're going to die. So before I came to Bristol, I lived in Surrey. And I was involved with a church there, and I had this youth group that I looked after. One of the kids in the youth group, 14-year-old lad, brilliant, brilliant guy, brilliant future ahead of him. His name's Matthew. He's gathered together with a few of his friends. It's Friday night, and they begin to talk about mortality. They begin to talk about the fleeting nature of life. You don't know when your time will come. And they talk, and one guy says, I'm really frightened of dying. I'm really frightened of death. And Matthew says, quote, I'm not afraid to die because I know that when I die, I'm going to be with Jesus. This is a guy with a profound faith. That was Friday night. Monday morning, his mother goes to wake him up. He's overslept. He should be in school. He hasn't risen. She hasn't heard a peep. She goes into his room. She sees he's still in the bed. She goes over to the bed. She sees a pile of vomit on the duvet dribbling down to the floor. He's unresponsive. She shakes. She screams. The ambulance comes. He's carried off. He's dead. Matthew was a beautiful, wonderful 14-year-old boy. And he died. He died because of a condition called EDS. Now, EDS, if you don't know it, it's a complex thing. It's unpredictable. It has a number of different outcomes and it works in different ways. So when Matthew dies, we were heartbroken, but not totally surprised. Because when he was born, his parents knew EDS. That's the diagnosis. That's the prognosis over his life. And when he was old enough as a little child, they explained it to him. With EDS, it's strange. For some people, it's quick. For others, it's prolonged. For some, it's super painful. For others, it's painless. EDS, it could take you tomorrow, next week, or in 60 years' time. You can live a long, long life, or you can be snuffed out at an early age. For some, EDS, it takes the mind first. For others, it attacks the body. But it's always, always fatal. It's chronic. It's uncurable. And he died because of EDS. Why do I tell you this story? Because I have EDS. Don't know when it will take me. I don't know how, but it will. And one day it will orphan my children and it will widow my wife. It could be today. It could be in 50 years' time. I have EDS. And so do you. Because EDS simply means everybody dies someday. Now, some of you, you're going there, oh, he just tricked us. There is no such thing as EDS. No, no. I've told you the exact truth. The march of time, the randomness of life, chance can happen. A friend of mine was killed in a car crash. Just a couple of weeks ago, EDS, everyone dies someday. And so what hope life? What meaning life? And this is where the book comes to a close. And he comes up with this kind of conclusion. But it's really, really interesting because what the teacher does after this whole examination of the meaninglessness, the futility of life, and this is in the Bible, he says, right, I'm going to give you two options. Two options. You've got to choose. You can choose whichever one that you want. Option number one is this. With option number one, you just enjoy life. He says this, enjoy life with your wife whom you love. Now he goes into more detail and he has, this is just one little example. But he basically says, there's no meaning, there's no ultimate fulfillment, there's no purpose. So enjoy, relax, take it easy, take a chill pill, have some fun, go out, enjoy yourself. Now, you can come, if you're not used to church, you don't normally come to church, you were brought by a friend, you thought, you know, it'd be an interesting thing, you didn't hate it, it wasn't horrible, but you know, this is it for you. You can go away and you can say, yeah, the preacher at church said, it's okay, the Bible says, best thing to do in life is just to enjoy your life. Enjoy food, enjoy your work, enjoy wisdom, enjoy wealth, enjoy wine, all of that stuff, women, relationships, have a ball, have a blast, because there's no ultimate meaning, so you might as well enjoy your life. Because it's Ecclesiastes, he goes on to say, enjoy life with your wife, whom you love, all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun. All your meaningless days, for this is your lot in life and your toilsome labor under the sun. Which is a great little Bible verse to put in people's wedding cards. Enjoy life with one another. All your meaningless life. I actually did that once. And that's what he says. It's logical. But I want you to notice this. He says, under the sun, under the sun, under the sun. He keeps referring to this, under the sun, under the sun, under the heavens. Life is meaningless. Life is unknowable. Life is ephemeral. Life is futile. Life is a vapor. Life is chasing after bubbles. Under the sun, under the heavens. What does that mean? It means that within the course of human experience, you just can't know what the meaning of life is all about. You can't get it. It won't hold for you. So if you're living within our human limited experience, enjoy yourself. But he says there is a second option. You don't live under the sun, you look for what's outside of the sun. Here's option number two. And this is, it just comes right before the mic drop. And it's very simple. He says this, remember your creator in the days of your youth. Read that with me. Remember your creator in the days of your youth. So he does this whole book. And he says, without the creator, without God, there is no meaning in life. There is no purpose in life. There is no understanding that we get from life. You actually have to look outside of the sun. You have to look outside of human experience. You have to look at the creator. Remember him. Factor him in. And some of you, you say, well, I'm not a Christian. I don't believe in that stuff. This is the message that the Bible says. Without God, there's no meaning. So enjoy your life and just make the most of it and hope that you have an okay time. But if you can, think about the Creator. When you're young, before you get just sucked in and dragged down into the rat race of human existence, enjoy and remember the Creator. Think about him. Because ultimately, the question of the meaning of life is not a moral one, and it's not a philosophical one. Let me take you back to my riddle, and then we're going to finish. The riddle that I gave you, she's my mother, but she couldn't possibly carry me. She's my wife, but it was impossible for her to marry me. Someone shout out the answer. Anyone know? How about my daughter, Zoe? Shout out the answer, Zoe. We should have rehearsed this. You do know, you just haven't thought about it, because the answer is Kate Gennardo. My mother is Kate Gennardo, but my wife is also Kate Gennardo. The she is two people. And if you know me, it's actually relatively easy. My mother, she couldn't marry me. My wife, she couldn't carry me. They're not one, but they're two people. The only way to know that answer is to know me, to be related to me. And even then, you might need a pointer or two. Because the meaning of life is a question. It's not philosophical, it's relational. The only way that you can know about the meaning of life is to be in relationship with God, the Creator, the Father. Now, in a moment, we're going to pray, and I'd love to pray with you and just let you just go away, and we'll do some more worship and think about these things. But some of you, I know this for a fact, some of you are sitting there and you're thinking, yeah, but I don't believe in the Creator. I don't believe in God. What I've just done is I've given you 5 reasons why life without God makes no sense. It has ultimately no meaning. What I'm going to do in the next 5 weeks is I'm going to give you 5 reasons why it makes sense to believe in God. Because actually, there's good, logical, rational reasons for believing in God. And so we're going to look at cosmology, we're going to look at the universe, we're going to look at history, we're going to look at human experience, we're going to pile in. And if you have any desire to find out something that will set you up for life, you need to be here over the next few weeks. We have an alpha course coming up as well. So I'm going to pray for you right now. But before I do this, here's a quick sneak preview trailer for the next 5-week series, 5 Reasons Why. Watch the video, cheer, and then we'll come and close things up.